we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatments of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices radio show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO, in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, January the 22nd, 2016. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by our co-host, Carissa Thorpe. Say hello again.
Hello.
Okay. Didn't work the first time.
I feel like a parrot.
Welcome to the show, Carissa. Thanks so much for coming today. We have two great interviews for you today. As you may have heard in the last week, as of last month, the Ontario Human Rights Commission has updated its policy on creed to include the belief of ethical veganism. That is to say that ethical veganism will now be recognized as a human right in Ontario. That means you will not be able to be discriminated against for your beliefs towards animals and eating vegan in the workplace or in other public arenas if you are a resident in Ontario, which is huge news. It all started about 4 years ago with newly graduated law student Camille Labchuk when she took it to the Ontario Human Rights Commission to have this as part of their policy update. We had her on the show in 2012 to tell us about this, and you can listen to that interview on animalvoices.org if you like. And today she is here to give us an update. And for our feature interview, we'll have Dr. Carrie Cronin on the show, also a Canadian from Ontario. She is the co-founder of a new initiative called The Unbound Project. The Unbound Project is a multimedia and book project started with her colleague and famed animal photographer Joanne MacArthur, and its aim is to recognize and celebrate the women at the forefront of the animal advocacy movement. I just found out about this project a few weeks ago, and I'm excited to have Dr. Cronin on the show today to tell us all about it. That interview is coming up in about 32 minutes, so please do stay tuned.
So one of our former co-hosts, Alyssa Ray, received a note this week that we thought we would share because it's very interesting. And it's a really nice note from one of her former co-workers. She's off in Europe right now, Alyssa, and so she just recently left us here in Vancouver. And she got this note that says, "Thank you for being a vocal vegan. You were a gentle and significant influence for a lot of thinking. And a couple of months ago, I finally stopped waffling about it and went vegan. I feel so much better in so many ways, mostly no longer having to live with the cognitive dissonance of supporting the exploitation of animals. So I wanted to thank you because the way you carry yourself in the world and interact with others made a big difference to me, and I'm really grateful for that." So
I think that's just wonderful. And Alyssa shared that online on Facebook the other day, I think just yesterday, right?
Yeah.
Or the other day. And I asked her if we could share it because I think it's just so positive and heartwarming and motivational and inspirational just to get lovely notes like that.
Yeah. And I think, it's interesting to when you do have that experience where somebody has helped you in that way, just sort of witnessing the way somebody lives their life rather than it being somebody sending you lots of videos or whatever, to share that with them. I know for myself, that's sort of the way that I came into veganism, which I've shared on the show before, was I did a volunteer program called Katimovic, where you live in a house with a bunch of other people around the same age, and then there's a project leader who leads everything and takes care of everyone. And my project leader in my second rotation in Ontario was vegan. And because of being able to witness the way that she lived veganism when I was vegetarian and thought that it was such an insurmountable thing, that inspired me to eventually go vegan. I mean, it took a while, sort of the same thing as what this note is saying, but I did eventually go vegan because of that.
And, you know, I received an email from Colleen Patrick Goudreau today. Mm-hmm. She sends out an email every day called The Daily Dose of Compassion. And these are just little quotes of inspiration and wisdom that she basically has that comes out of her head. And today's quote today's Daily Dose of Compassion just really perfectly, I think, conveys what we're talking about right now. And she says, if people find ways to identify with you, they're more inclined to consider the changes they need to make in themselves. And I think that's just perfect, because I think it just all starts there. Because when you're living as an example and you're just carrying yourself off in a confident and authentic manner in the way that you live your vegan lifestyle, I think that it, first of all, not only does it's obviously going to influence people, and hopefully in a positive manner, as it did with Alyssa's coworker. But I think it also plants seeds in people's minds, because it shows them, perhaps it kind of opens their mind to, I guess, just sort of discover that they may be open to changes themselves.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought that was just a perfect summary of what we're talking about today.
And kind of just different little things where even if it's just like a really great dessert that you have or something that's vegan, it makes it look easier for people who maybe think that it's a difficult thing to do, if they could just sort of see you living that way, right?
Well, I'm on the co-op radio programming committee here at Co-op Radio. And speaking of desserts, we have a big meeting this weekend. We have to bring food. I'm like, oh, what am I going to bring that's going to impress everyone? and that won't take too long to make. Yeah. So I'm going to be making a raw chocolate raspberry tart. It's like a cheesecake. It looks really delicious, really easy to make too. And I just want to be a positive influence in people's lives too by way of food. So, of course, that's one way to do it as well. So speaking of food, Carissa, did you know that yesterday was National Cheese Lovers Day?
No, but I do know that it was like Squirrel Appreciation Day earlier this week.
Yeah, that could have been. I think that was either yesterday or the day before too, because I only know that because of the random photos of squirrels that appeared in my Facebook feed. But yeah, I just happened upon this. I actually looked it up just to make sure. And yeah, it was National Cheese Lovers Day. So what better reason than to speak about cheese, of course, vegan cheese, on today's show. And I used to actually be a hardcore lover of cheese myself back in my dairy days, and I know you're not a fan of the vegan cheeses, but did you like the dairy cheeses yourself?
I really only liked like cheddar cheese, and that was it.
Okay,
so I wasn't like a specialty cheese lover or anything.
Yeah, but you definitely have specialty tastes, I'll say. Yeah. Anyways, you know, it was the first, I would say, main food item that I had to slowly wean myself off of when I decided that I no longer wanted to partake in the cruelties of the dairy industry. And of course, for people who aren't aware what those cruelties are, just a couple of them. When a mother cow, of course, has to be pregnant to lactate and produce all the milk, and that's why I said mother cow. There's no other way to, and some people just don't realize that cows, like all mammals, need to be pregnant and lactating and have babies in order to produce milk. And their babies are taken away from their mothers at birth. How would you like it if you're a mother and your baby was taken away from you at birth? That's how I always see it, is like, try to identify with, like, they're just like us. They are just like us. The baby female calves are taken away to be put into the dairy industry, where they're used and abused for 3 to 4 years and then sent to slaughter. The male calves are sent away to the veal industry, where they are sent to slaughter much quicker, in about 5 weeks. And there's a plethora of health-related problems associated with dairy, of course, which we are not meant to be consuming after weaning, and certainly not a cow's milk, which is meant to grow a baby calf into a 2,000-pound adult cow. So, fast forward here. The vegan cheese offerings commercially available these days have grown and improved so much in just the last year or two. And I just wanted to talk about some of my favorites that have just come out recently, like literally in the last couple of years. I won't go too much into Daya cheese, because everyone really knows about Daya, but they do have, they're always coming out with new offerings and new and improved, and they're made out of tapioca. What I do like this year, and what seems to be all the rage, is the field roast chow slices. I know you're not a fan, Carissa, because they're made out of coconut oil.
Ugh.
So they're not made out, well, a lot of people like coconut. They're not made out of soy. They're not made out of the de tapioca, but they're made out of coconut oil. I was looking at the ingredients the other day, and they have a couple flavors, coconut, plain, and the tomato cayenne. And then the Follow Your Heart brand as well has started offering similar slices. They have garden urban provolone, mozzarella, and American style. But what I really wanted to talk about, a couple that you haven't tried, Carissa, that I really feel that is worth your time, because these cheeses might actually agree with you. You might actually really like them. And what they taste like is like they're cultured cheeses. Mm-hmm. And these are the Tal Ronan's Kite Hill cheese, which I talked a little bit about on the show a couple months ago when we had him on the show. I had sampled some from Hawaii because you can only buy it in the States. And Miyoko's Creamery cheese, which is also hard to get here in Canada, but has so many wonderful flavors, such as a French style winter truffle, which is to die for. I ate the whole thing at once. It was that good. I've never done that with cheese before. Right now in my fridge, I have Mount Vesuvius Black Ash, which is really good. They have a double cream sun-dried tomato garlic, an aged English smoked farmhouse, to name others. Also just came out with vegan butter this last couple of weeks. And these two brands are really worth trying. They're cultured, for one thing, which is different than the other cheeses. So they're aged and they're left there to ferment and culture and with the probiotics. And with the Kite Hill cheese, it's made out of almonds, but they actually make their all own almond milk, which is different than all the other cheeses. And Miyoka's cheeses are made out of cashews, at least the one that I have in my fridge. I checked the ingredients just to make sure. Made out of cashews. Definitely worth trying out. So you know what? If I have any of that Miyoko's left, the next time I see you, I'm going to bring you some. So you can get a chance. The Kite Hill, though, they're just amazing.
Stuff that basically most things that Tal Ronan produces, I tend to like. So awesome. Maybe that would
He's
be
great.
It.
He's great. So next, what we have up is, I'm very excited to announce this, is the film, which is an expose uncovering the cruelties of the Vancouver Aquarium. It's called Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered, and it is made by local filmmaker Gary Charbonneau, who we had earlier on the show last year. It talks about the Vancouver Aquarium, talks about the problems with their animals in captivity, that is the whales and dolphins, cetaceans, and exposes the cruelties. It is now, it was making the rounds sort of at film festivals and public film screenings since last summer. It's now available for free online, which I think is wonderful. And I just wanted to let everyone know about that. Please go look it up. You can find it on YouTube and on Vimeo. We have links to both of those videos on our website at animalvoices.org, and it's also posted on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. So what does this mean, having this expose film? It's a feature-length film documentary out for free now. What it means is that you can encourage your friends to watch it. You can encourage people who take their kids to the aquarium, the local aquarium. Maybe, you know, there's the film Blackfish, right? And it's a similar type of expose, but it talks about SeaWorld. Maybe that hasn't resonated with people, but here we are in Vancouver and it's happening here. Like this aquarium facility is here in Vancouver. And there's been many problems at the Vancouver Aquarium with the animals, with the way that they're kept, and early deaths and stress in the animals, much the same as in Blackfish. And now you can show it to people online.
Well, and we're so connected with SeaWorld too. Like a lot of our animals are on loan to SeaWorld.
That's a good point.
Or like the breeding is connected. So I think people can sometimes with Blackfish think that there's that separation, but really it's very connected.
I have to say, too, about this film is that it's very thoroughly researched. Gary Charbonneau brings up many, 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 many points. It's not just like this one thing, this orca whale died early. No, it's so many things. It's a gamut of things. It's politics. It's just educational controversies. Like, is this really an educational aspect of the aquarium? It's the way that they run their business as a nonprofit. Very well worth watching. And now you can watch it for free online.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news, from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independent like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.ca.
Maine and Hastings, every second Monday from 4 to 5 p.m. We talk about violence against women, animal rights, local poetry, homelessness, and other downtown Eastside issues. Don Larson covers the news and interviews, and his sidekick, Mark Bignell, spins local indie music. Maine and Hastings is well-aged, 30 years. It puts the O in organic, original, and radio. Maine and Hastings on Vancouver Co-op Radio, every second Monday at 4 p.m., broadcasting from the old heart of the city.
You're listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
Tomorrow, between 3 and 4 p.m. at the corner of Commercial and Hastings, is Liberation BC's first chicken slaughterhouse vigil of 2016. This is a monthly event that occurs where activists come together to bear witness and educate the public about the suffering of chickens and what people can do about it. Signs will be provided, but you can feel free to bring your own. And I think you've been to those before, right, Allison?
No, I've never been to a chicken vigil, but we've talked about it many times on the show before, done little interviews about it. Darren, one of our co-hosts, is this the one in Vancouver? Sorry, he's one of the co-organizers of it.
Yeah, and it's a really, especially if you're new to activism, it's a really great way to sort of get into it because it is basically, it's pretty easy. It's just holding a sign and bearing witness as the trucks take chickens into the slaughterhouse.
And actually, the Huffington Post did an article about these actual chicken vigils in Vancouver happening. So if people want to find out more about it, go to the Huffington Post and I guess just type in chicken vigil and you'll be able to read an article about it that was published not too long ago.
And also tomorrow from 2 to 4 p.m. at Spartacus Books, which is at 3378 Findlay Street in Vancouver, B.C., which is just sort of off where Commercial becomes Victoria, is the Book of Tofu Vancouver launch party. After the success of the Kickstarter funding campaign, Tofu Magazine is set to celebrate the publishing of its first anthology, The Book of Tofu, and you can come along and pick up a copy. And there may also be some tofu aprons, and volunteers from all our bodies will be on hand with a local zine, and Driftwood from Portland, Oregon will be tabling with their wares as well.
They're a vegan travel magazine, right?
Yeah, I think they've, I'm not sure how many issues they've put out now. I know their first issue came out in July, so they might be on their second or third now.
I think it was just that one, as far as I know. Looks really good so far.
Yeah, I wrote for the first magazine, so I got a free copy, and it's amazing. It's really nice paper. And it says, to top it all off, snacks will also be provided by Zen Conscious Lounge and Vegan Devour. And Zen Conscious Lounge, I haven't been to, but they actually donate.
Everyone raves about it.
Yeah, I've heard good things, and they're a non-profit. They donate all of their profits to different charities. And I actually heard somebody overheard on the SkyTrain, one of the people who works there, talking about how the employees actually get to choose which charity it goes to every 6 months.
Well, that's fantastic. And they're located in Yale Town.
Yeah. And finally, there is a DXC meetup and volunteering at Rabbitats coming up on February 14th on Valentine's Day at 10 a.m. And you can meet at 186 East 20th Avenue. And then there will be a meetup, and then they will head over to Rabbitats, which is a rabbit shelter, to help out and clean the cages and hang out with the rabbits.
Well, thanks so much for the events today, Carissa.
No problem.
For our first interview today, we have animal rights lawyer Camille Labchuk on the show. Camille works as the executive director of the animal law advocacy organization called Animal Justice. She takes on cases and campaigns designed to expose animal cruelty and improve legal protections for animals. But also, as a recently graduated law student back in 2012, she had presented a case before the Ontario Human Rights Commission to have veganism recognized as a human right under the provincial law. As of last month, there is now progress on this undertaking, and Ontario is now one step closer to recognizing veganism as a human right under the law. She is here today to give us an update on this issue. Hello, Camille, and welcome back to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, Allison. It's great to be here.
Well, we had you on the show in 2012 to explain to us the case that you had just presented before the Ontario Human Rights Commission at the time to have veganism recognized as a human right, as they were updating their definition of creed under the law. Can you tell us about why the commission was updating its policy to reconsider the definition of creed?
Sure. Well, the Ontario Human Rights Commission is a very important policy-setting body for the province of Ontario. And one of the things it does is try to ensure that people's human dignity is respected to the maximum extent possible. So they set policies to help employers and service providers and landlords accommodate people and their beliefs and their disabilities and all of their other human rights. So they set policies in relation to creed as well. And the last time they issued a policy on creed was in 1995, so quite some time ago. And in the interim, thinking about what matters to people and why we protect those beliefs has evolved. So back when their 1995 policy was set, they defined creed as merely meaning religion. So no beliefs that might not be religious in nature were deemed protected by the commission. But in the interim, we, definitely have seen a decline in religions and a rise in other belief systems, for example, ethical veganism, that are just as important to people as their religions. And so one of the arguments before the commission was, you know, why just protect religion? Why not protect these other beliefs too? And we're very happy that that's one that they accepted.
And can you tell us about how the consultation process that Animal Justice was involved in with the commission on updating its policy on creed went? How were you able to consult, and what was the response of the commission towards your input?
Well, there were a couple of phases. So the commission, to its credit, embarked on a very exhaustive process. They really heard from anyone who wanted to be heard from. So we did two things. First of all, we presented our research and our presentation at a symposium in 2012 that was held at York University at the law school. And that was before commissioners, the public was invited. It was a process where a number of academics and interested members made submissions. And they talked about what they thought that the new policy should include. So I was there on behalf of Animal Justice, or as we were then known, Lawyers for Animal Welfare. And we talked about why ethical veganism was a belief like a religion in some ways that deserved protection. And there was another presenter as well, Dr. David Stiebel, who's a philosopher of some renown, and presented a very similar perspective. So we started the conversation that way. And phase two was a public input period that the commission hosted. And they actually had a fantastic online survey that any Ontarian could fill out to gather their views on what creed should mean and how it should be applied. And I was very encouraged when I saw the survey, because one of the examples they kept using was, should creed have non-ethical beliefs or non-religious beliefs included? And they always used the example of like ethical veganism. So at that point, we thought it was a pretty good sign that they were willing to do something progressive.
Yeah, so last month, the Ontario Human Rights Commission finally issued the updated policy on preventing discrimination based on creed. Can you tell us what the new statement says and how this affects the ethical belief of veganism?
Sure. So the new statement, unlike the last one that said creed was specifically religion only, the new statement says that creed is capable of encompassing ethical beliefs that, like a religion, form a substantial part of a person's worldview and belief system. So they didn't specifically say ethical veganism, but it's pretty clear to me that, for ethical vegans, that really is their belief system. It's our worldview. It's the lens through which we see the world. So I think there's a very good chance that when these cases finally do get decided, that ethical veganism will be included.
So what does this logistically mean for the future of the rights of vegans in Ontario? Can you give us some examples as to how this new code may come into play to protect those who carry the ethical belief of veganism?
Yeah, so it's a really important statement that people's beliefs matter, whether they're religious or non-religious in nature. And I hear all the time from people who are vegan or vegetarian who say that they face problems because of their beliefs. So, for example, some people will perhaps they work in a facility that prepares food, like a home to care for people, and perhaps that they're asked to prepare non-vegan food at times and feel uncomfortable doing this because of their belief system. Under a policy that includes ethical veganism as a form of creed, they would have to be accommodated and offered a task that they can comply with based on their belief system. Likewise, someone who's in a hospital who has no way of getting food for herself would be required to be provided with vegan appropriate food. Same thing with somebody in an institution or a prison. It also could affect workplaces that might want to have workplace social events at locations that could be exclusionary to vegans. So, for example, if a workplace always had its major social event of the week at a steakhouse, which isn't really appropriate for people who have ethical belief in veganism, they might be required to have other events as well so that vegans can fully participate. So I expect we're going to keep hearing from people as the news about the policy spreads.
Yeah, so this news has really started to make news in even mainstream media in the last week, and it's been like blowing up on my social media. I'm wondering, what kind of feedback you've received from, say, both sides, that is, the vegans in your social networks and just the mainstream people.
Well, most of the feedback, in fact, nearly all of it, is very excited. People are thrilled to hear that something that's so important to them, that really permeates every fiber of their being, which is ethical veganism, is on its way to being recognized as a human right. That's just a really important recognition for people. The mainstream media has started to cover it as well. There's been some interest from mainstream outlets, and I really do think that as news spreads, people will become more and more excited to learn about this really progressive step.
So I'm wondering if a resident of Ontario feels that he or she is being discriminated against because of his or her belief about animals, what should he or she do, and how can animal justice help?
I'm happy to assist people with these issues. They can contact Animal Justice via our website, animaljustice.ca. I've already heard from a number of people who do face these issues, and I know some of them have even been going to their employers, for example, with issues. Oftentimes, employers are happy to accommodate. They pay close attention to Human Rights Commission policies as their legal obligation to do, and they do want to ensure that people are accommodated to the extent that they can be. If somebody has a difficult case and they're not making progress, Animal Justice is happy to step in and assist them. And we're, of course, standing by to help anybody that needs help.
And I'm wondering, too, how do you see this progress in Ontario as a potential stepping stone to extend into the human rights codes of other provinces in Canada and maybe even beyond that as well? What do you think the future holds for precedent setting?
I think it sets a very important precedent that these types of beliefs deserve protection. As the legislation stands now in other provinces, there are already a number of other jurisdictions that are capable of getting ethical veganism in as a belief in the same way. So we're hoping to do work in those other provinces as well. Your listeners should know that at the federal level, the Human Rights Act, the Charter of Canadian Rights and Freedoms, does protect people's freedom of conscience, which has been defined in cases to include a belief in vegetarianism or veganism. So people already do receive protections from government institutions based on their veganism. And excitedly, I've been in touch with a lot of lawyers around the world who are working on these issues, whether they're in the United States, in Europe. There's actually a European Convention of Vegan Lawyers going on in April. And one of the things that they want to discuss is the success in Ontario and how they can start bringing that into other jurisdictions that don't have protections. So I think this really is a global international movement, and I think we're making progress.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today, Camille, to give us an update on the work you've been doing with the Ontario Human Rights Commission to recognize veganism as a human right. To find out more about the work that Camille does at Animal Justice, please visit animaljustice.ca. Thanks, Camille, and have a great day.
Thanks, Allison.
You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And right now we have some news.
Oscar nominee Leonardo DiCaprio was honored with the Crystal Award for improving the state of the world earlier this week as part of the World Economic Forum in Switzerland. During his acceptance speech, DiCaprio announced his pledge of $15 million for sustainability and conservation projects around the world. "We simply cannot afford to allow the corporate greed of the coal, oil, and gas industries to determine the future of humanity," he said. "Those entities with a financial interest in preserving the destructive system have denied, and even covered up, the evidence of our changing climate. Enough is enough. You know better. The world knows better. History will place the blame for this devastation squarely at their feet," he went on to say. According to one online report, DiCaprio's donations will include $6 million to Oceana and SkyTruth for their global fishing watch, $1 million to the Nature Conservancy, and $3.2 million to the Rainforest Action Network and Haka to help protect rainforests, among other initiatives. This is actually the second time in 6 months that the Revenant star has made such a pledge, for a total of $30 million towards stopping the destructive effects of climate change. And in an interesting news item about news itself, the environmentally minded blog and news outlet EcoRazzie is set to relaunch as a fully vegan news source. As of Monday, January 25th, EcoRazzie says they will be committed to being the ethical destination for all things news, pop culture, and food. The announcement went on to say that vegans and soon-to-be vegans will find EcoRazzie to be a necessary frame of reference on viral news, with articles like "How Ricky Gervais Exploits Animal Lovers," "Our Single Issue Campaign Setting the Animal Rights Movement Backwards," and "What Exactly Is Aquafaba?" Are you vegan? Thinking about going vegan? If you don't answer with a resounding hell yeah, prepare to have your mind change. We're laying a vegan smackdown on typical viral media that shies away from controversy and ignores the necessity to protect all animals. When we say unapologetic, we mean it. We are empowering vegan activists and breaking down all the tired old excuses everyone's sick of hearing. It's time for vegans to have a collective voice that puts the lives of all sentient beings first without compromise. And EcoRazzie is ready to provide content like none you've ever seen.
You know what? I didn't know that they weren't vegan before yesterday when I found out about this.
I think they were like really super close to vegan, but rarely there would be some stories that like weren't quite.
Now they're announcing we're animal rights activists, which is really cool. So we're going to be keeping on the forefront of what they're doing.
It also said, what's going to make EcoRazzie so different from other vegan websites you've been visiting? Simple. We don't only critique the ways in which we treat animals, we reject using them at all. Our belief is clear. Animals have the right to live peacefully, and there's no way for that to happen if we continue to exploit them unnecessarily. Be ready to find commentary on current events and breaking news, innovative recipes, and essays from those who have put veganism at the forefront of their hearts, minds, and plates. And finally, this is a story from CBC. An animal rights protest organized by a Toronto teen blocked traffic and attendees at an African trophy hunting show just north of the city on Saturday. About two dozen people joined 18-year-old Remington Latinville, founder of the group Ban African Trophy Hunting, outside of the venue in Concord. The protesters carried signs and yelled at people as they headed into the show. Latinville argues that public shaming is warranted. "I think it's just so selfish and wrong of these people to be killing innocent, beautiful animals just for trophies," she told CBC News. The Africa Show, run by African Events Canada, connects safari operators with potential customers who could then travel to African countries like Mozambique or South Africa to pay to hunt exotic animals. Vendors can charge thousands of dollars to kill a single animal. To kill an elephant, for example, it can cost up to $50,000. The entire African big game hunting industry is estimated to be worth nearly $1 billion, with a portion of that money going toward conservation efforts. One tour operator from the Eastern Cape of South Africa said in an interview that trophy hunters are only targeting specific animals, old males past their breeding years, and that placing dollar values on animals has contributed immensely to conservation programs across the continent. In many parts of Africa, big game hunting has support from both hunters and local governments. Similar trophy hunting expeditions has sparked criticism throughout North America. I know there's a lot going on here with grizzly bears.
Yeah, for sure. Trophy hunting, it's unfortunately a reality here in Canada. Well, thank you for the news, Carissa. For our feature interview today, we have Dr. Carrie Cronin on the show. She is an associate professor in the Department of Visual Arts at Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario. She is also a faculty affiliate in Brock's Social Justice and Equity Studies graduate program and a founding member of the Social Justice Research Institute at Brock. Today, she is here to speak with us about the Unbound Project, a multimedia and book project created by herself and acclaimed photojournalist Joanne MacArthur. The Unbound Project aims to recognize and celebrate women at the forefront of animal advocacy in both a contemporary and historical context. Hello, Carrie, and welcome to the Animal Voices Show.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me.
Well, to start, please tell us what inspired you and Joanne to conceive the Unbound Project.
Well, actually, Joanne originally had this idea. She'd been compiling a list for a really, really long time of women who have inspired her to do the work that she's doing, of course, her photography work. So she's been working on this list for many, many years. And then she approached me, I think it was back in 2013. We just sort of had a casual conversation, and she asked if I would like to come on board as a collaborator. And it's just sort of grown from there. I think Joanne was interested in bringing me on board because I do a lot of research on historical aspects of animal advocacy, and she really conceived of this project as having a real broad scope in terms of, you know, geography, countries in the world, but also in time periods, so not just contemporary activism, but also a historical piece as well. So we started talking, we started brainstorming. We had a really wonderful dinner, I remember, at Crossroads in L.A. We were both there for an event that the National Museum of Animals and Society was having. It was actually an exhibit of Joanne's work, and we just ate good food, and we talked, and we just brainstormed, and got really, really excited about the project. We really got things going, I would say, about a year ago. We got the website up and running, our social media site, and we started posting content. But really, this has sort of been a long conversation between us for quite some time.
And specifically, why are you choosing to share women's stories in animal advocacy?
Well, we've both noticed in our own separate work that there are so many women, both today and in the past, that are working so hard to make a difference for animals, so many unsung heroes. But in a lot of organizations, we see, you know, the leadership tends to be men, which is great, and they're doing wonderful work. But all of these women that are, you know, on the ground, raising funds, protesting, you know, getting themselves arrested, all of these other things that they're doing, really not getting a lot of recognition and credit for the hard work that they're doing. You know, there's this real division we see in a lot of organized animal advocacy between a sort of a gender imbalance. There's so, so many women doing the work, and so few of them getting recognized for it. So this is something that we wanted to sort of help correct with this project. We wanted to shine the spotlight on the work of these women who often go unnoticed or unrecognized. And as I said, this is happening today, but it's also happened historically speaking when I'm, you know, working with archival materials and reading about organizations from the late 19th century, for example. You know, you often have a man on the letterhead. He's the head of the organization. But if you read through the minutes of the meetings, you know, there's mostly women that are doing the hard work, the groundwork. And in some cases, we don't even know their names. So we're trying to correct that with this project.
And what is the significance of the name Unbound?
Unbound. Well, that took us a while to come up with. You know, for a while, this was kind of the nameless project because we wanted to hit on a phrase or a term that really resonated with both of us and sort of captured what it is we were trying to do. One day, it just sort of came together as we were sort of tossing things around. We see Unbound as sort of having a few different sort of symbolic levels, if you will. First of all, we're thinking about the boundless enthusiasm and efforts of these women. I mean, if you were to harness all this energy, you know, collectively over time and over different places, it's just amazing to think about. But we're also thinking about Unbound in terms of breaking free of constraints. I'm thinking of things like gender stereotypes, you know, especially with some of the historical work that I do. Women were out, you know, putting themselves on the front line, trying to change the world for animals, even before they had the right to vote themselves. So there's a lot of those kinds of sort of boundaries and constraints that women have had to face socially that are sort of being broken through some of these efforts. And then also the connection goes back to animals, you know, that sort of literal freeing them of oppressive situations, cages, restraints, that a lot of women are working to do. So we see Unbound, the name, sort of working on a number of different levels.
And you say that far too often people believe that they do not have enough time, money, or expertise to get involved in animal advocacy and that people misunderstand what it means to be an activist. Can you elaborate on what you mean by this?
I hear over and over again from people I talk to that, you know, they love animals, they want to make a difference for animals in the world, but, you know, oh, I'm not an activist. This is sort of a phrase I hear a lot. We got talking about this, and we got talking about how there tends to be this really limited view of what activism means, this sort of conception that to be an activist, you have to, you know, be out on the street holding a sign, dressed in a certain way, behaving in a certain way. And we're kind of trying to challenge the stereotype with this project. So for everybody out there who is out demonstrating and holding signs, great. That's fabulous. We need you. Keep doing what you're doing. But we also recognize that there are many ways to be active in changing the world for animals and that one model doesn't fit all. So we're encouraging people through this project to find ways in their own lives, their own jobs, their own comfort zones to do this. So that there's no one way to be an activist. We're really trying to get that message out there. So by featuring a range of different women and their stories, we're going to be drawing together sort of a collection of diverse ways of thinking about activism or advocacy work or how to change the world for animals. What I mean is that we're featuring women that you know, founded sanctuaries, but we're also featuring artists, chefs, vegan business owners, lawyers, doctors, teachers. We're also working on featuring a lot of young women, you know, teenagers who are starting animal rights clubs in their school or perhaps other kinds of ways of being involved. We have some young women, for example, who are making art and then selling it on the internet, and that money goes to their local rescue group. So we want to really highlight that there's so many different ways that one can get involved, that you don't have to just follow some sort of stereotypical model of what it means to be an activist, that we can all play a part in making the world a kinder and gentler place for animals.
So I'm wondering if you can maybe give us a few specific examples of some of the stories that you've already shared of women at the forefront of animal advocacy, perhaps one historical and one contemporary story.
Certainly. So contemporary, we kicked off our feature articles series with Dr. Aisha Akhtar, who's a medical doctor and a public health specialist in the United States. And her work was just really, really interesting to us because here she is coming from this, you know, world of medicine, and, you know, she has all of the scientific knowledge and background that comes along with that. But her work, her mission really is about raising awareness or education about the ways in which public health issues are linked directly back to the way we as a society treat animals. So I'm talking about things like disease, not only, you know, transfer of disease between human and animals, like avian flu or those kinds of things, but also she's looking at things like high cholesterol from diets that include a lot of meat. She's looking at things like, you know, people being injured or killed in situations where animals are used for entertainment. So there's a lot of different ways that she's exploring this idea of the relationship between human health, public health, and the treatment of animals. And her work is so groundbreaking in this area. I don't think anybody else is really exploring it in this way. And because she's got this position as a doctor and as a specialist in human health, her work is being taken up in circles that sort of are different than the regular activist or advocacy circles. And I think that's really important to think about, is where this work is being read or who's being reached by this work. So we were really inspired by her, and we chose to kick off our feature stories with her because we really love what she's doing.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. And I know you've got some stories of historical figures as well. Maybe you could share one of those too.
Absolutely. As I said, my passion is history, although I love all of these stories. They're so wonderful. But there's one woman in particular, if I could time travel, I would just go back and meet her for sure. Her name is Ada Cole, and she was from Britain. And in the early 20th century in England, she really started to make a difference for horses that were being transported as part of the live export from England to the European continent. And she was just an average citizen. You know, she didn't come from an activist background. She didn't, you know, have any sort of desire to be an activist. But one day she happened to witness a sort of a parade of really sick and injured and dying horses. And this was just really painful for her to see. She didn't really understand what was going on. She did some investigation and realized that these horses were being sort of marched off a boat that had come across the channel from England, and they were being marched to their own death. They were being marched to a slaughterhouse. And their conditions were just horrific, and she just realized that this was wrong and that she wanted to do something and make a difference. So she started just single-handedly working to raise awareness, to educate people about what was happening in this industry, this live export industry. She was one of the first, if not the first, but in my research I'm sort of saying that she's one of the first because I can't definitively prove it, to use film and photography as a way to investigate cruelty. So, you know, way back before the First World War, she was going out to these locations with her camera, putting herself at great risk. She got roughed up by the workers who didn't, of course, want her to take pictures of what she found in these horrific situations. Eventually, she did end up partnering with the RSPCA in England to help change the laws around live export. But really, this began as just one woman who saw something wrong and wanted to change it. And I just find her story so inspiring. And so we're delighted to be featuring her. We're working on some more in-depth pieces about her right now.
Yeah, I definitely find that story inspiring as well. And if you hadn't just told it to us right now, I would have never known about this woman who seems to share the same last name as me, too, which is pretty cool. But yeah, just speaking on like chronicling history, no one else is really doing it. So I guess my question is what do you aspire to achieve in chronicling this type of history? Like, I think you're the only ones that are telling these stories of historical women in animal advocacy.
We're one of the few. I should give credit certainly to the National Museum of Animals and Society in LA. They're also working hard to chronicle this history. They've got a new permanent exhibit just opening up later this year that I've been sort of helping with too. But certainly you're right, there's not a lot of focus on this history. And in fact, there's a lot of people that don't know anything about this history. When I talk to people about the history of animal advocacy or the work of people like Ada Cole, they're just completely blown away that this, you know, has existed longer than a couple of decades, this concern for animal rights or animal advocacy. So I think that there's a lot of value in knowing our history if, as people who want to change the world for animals. I think we kind of owe it to those who went before to acknowledge, to recognize what they did. We need to also acknowledge and recognize that they were not living in 2016. You know, they had different social conventions and different sort of cultural contexts that they were working with, so we can't expect that they would do their advocacy in the exact same way that we are doing now. But having said that, I think there's a whole lot that we can learn from them. As I go through these archives, the letters and pamphlets and stuff, I can see that a lot of the themes and concerns and ideas and frustrations that they were dealing with are very similar to what we're dealing with today. So I think it's important that we sort of work from that and learn from that and honor that, celebrate that. For example, I'm thinking of a woman named Maud Freshall. She was in the United States, and she was part of a group called the Millennium Guild. She was making alternatives to fur coats in the early 20th century. She didn't want people to have to wear fur. I mean, this is just mind-blowing to me that this is not something that our generation has invented. And so I think that it's really important that we honor that history. I want to also acknowledge that this history is hard to piece together. It hasn't always been valued, so the archival materials haven't always been collected or preserved with the same care that archival materials on other subjects perhaps might have been. So as I'm doing this work, you know, there's a lot of gaps in what we know. The archive is really, you know, imperfect. We're working with what we have. And I think that's also one of the motivations for the NBAM project, is that we kind of want to continue to create an archive with what we're doing with this project. So we are telling stories from history, but we're also chronicling and recording stories from our own time or from a more recent past. So we see the NBAM project as a living archive that will sort of gather this and continue to keep this history going.
So I understand that this is both a multimedia project as well as it's going to be a book. Can you maybe explain what exactly that means, what the multimedia aspects are, and how the book will look?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've envisioned this as a five-year project, and we've deliberately decided to put the book at the end. It's sort of going to be like the wrap or the cap on the project. So leading up to that over the coming years, we're going to be using our website and social media channels to publish essays, stories about the women, interviews, photo essays, of course, featuring Joanne's fabulous photography. We've also been working with some video artists who are creating little short videos about some of the contemporary women that we're working with. I'm also working with a local woman here in St. Catharines, where I live, who's an expert at animation, and she's going to be working with me putting together little shorts about some of the historical pieces that we're featuring, which I'm really, really excited about. We're also looking to do an exhibit at the National Museum of Animals and Society in L.A., in a couple of years' time, probably, when we have the material a little bit more concrete. So, and that will likely have a traveling component, too, so the exhibit will be able to go to different communities and outreach. And as I said, then we'll wrap up with a book at the end. We're envisioning sort of a very beautiful book that allows for a lot of photo essays, a lot of illustrations, somewhat similar to Joanne's We Animals book. It'll be different in terms of content, but that sort of style in terms of having a lot of images going along with the text.
So what I'm seeing from all these stories is that you're demonstrating through these inspiring examples how we can all make a difference for the animals with whom we share this planet. Is that what you hope to achieve as well, is to empower people and maybe even specifically women?
Absolutely. We're hoping that this project will inspire others to speak up, to challenge the status quo. As I said, to sort of think about how in their own lives, in their own context, they can, you know, make a difference for animals. We want to show the range of ways that we can, you know, change the conversations about animals, the way we're treating them. And we want to also build a sense of community. Sometimes people working for animals or caring for animals can feel really isolated, especially if they're not living in a big city, if they're living in a community where they may feel like they're the only person who cares or that's doing this. They may feel discouraged or despair, like all of us do at some point with advocacy work. And so we're hoping that this is an uplifting project, that it's celebratory, that it inspires people, that it starts conversations. We're just hoping that it'll generate a lot more good for animals in the world.
So what can our listeners do to support the work of the Unbound Project at this time?
Okay, so if you wanted to find us on social media, we have Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And certainly if anybody was interested in sharing the posts that we put up, we try to do regular posts, a couple each week, just with stories or sharing some of the good news that's happening in the world of some of these women or the organizations that they run. We would be delighted if people could share our posts, help get the word out. We also have on our website a nominations form. So if you know of someone in your community that you think should be featured in the Unbound Project, we want to hear from you. We have a lot of, you know, big-name activist women that we're definitely featuring, and those stories are in the works. But we also want to hear from the grassroots, the local, the young women that are in high school working on, you know, building an animal rights club in their community, for example. We want to know about these stories. And so we're encouraging people to go to our website. It's unboundproject.org. And there's a little tab that says nominations. You can just fill it out, tell us who you think should be featured, why, and we look forward to chatting with you about it.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today, Carrie, to speak about the Unbound Project. Sounds really exciting and inspiring. You're doing wonderful work. Our listeners can read essays and stories and find out more about it at unboundproject.org. Thanks, Carrie, and have a great day.
Thanks so much for having me. Bye-bye.
So once again, you've been listening to Animal Voices. Please join us on next week's show, which is next Friday, January the 22nd. I can't confirm what's on it yet, but I kind of want to say it might be super, super awesome. So you better tune in. But in case
it's not super, super awesome,
you should still tune in. But I don't want to say who we might have on next week's show. It's not confirmed yet. So anyways, we here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animal Voices is where you can stream shows or download them as podcasts. You can read our show blog there with detailed links, and we are on iTunes as well. Please stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. We do need help at Animal Voices, producing shows, hosting, doing interviews. If you're at all interested, please send me an email, radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We're going to be closing the show now with a song by a Canadian female artist. Her name is Lila Rose. This is Heart Machine. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Oh, you're full of surprises. You show me again. Well, I'm in my mind but now questions I question. Well, you made your way into my core, the core that I backed up with roses and tears of the last one who made it. So leave it, just leave it. 'Cause I'm built like a machine and I've come to take you and your heart. I will take it. You don't give it so freely. So let's make this easy. Just give me now, give me, just give me your heart. And I've come to take you and your heart.